This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Around this idea for a long time, even really since we were together growing up as kids, about going off on a road trip and telling stories together. It was kind of like trying to find parts of the United States that felt good to us, that inspired us, that kind of, so we could like live through whatever romantic ideas of the country we had through listening to music from the 60s or like reading whatever literature seemed so far removed from what we were in our version of America. So we decided to do it on bikes, basically. That seemed like the most appropriate way. And I left Berlin for that. I flew back to this country. And my brother and I met up in Asheville, North Carolina, with this loose framework of an idea, you know, find some kind of alternative America, find an America where people are trying to get back to themselves, back to community, back to the land, back to the more visceral aspects of life that we've kind of systematically removed ourselves from through the industrialization and suburbanization of this country. So that was the concept. I mean, we had no idea what we were getting ourselves into.
So what kind of people did you meet along the way?
Well, we met all kinds of people. We met far and away, like most people we met were just ordinary, traditional, rural Americans. Because, I mean, this is a big country. There's a lot of space between cities. And when you're on a bicycle, you feel every single mile that you go. And, you know, every corner store you is a conversation because you're these weird-looking foreigners on bikes and everyone wants to know what you're doing, where you're coming from. So, I mean, most of the people were just your well-meaning, conservative, rural Southerners. We were actively seeking out, though, slightly more radical, progressive-minded people, I guess you could say, who were very actively trying to use their resources and use their privilege to build lifestyles that are more in line with what I was just saying, with living more hyper, like locally, like on a very exaggerated level, living in community, producing food, writing your own music, making your own art, and kind of just making your surroundings your own and your kind of your livelihood and your source of happiness and your source of success.
I'm trying to imagine the concepts that you're speaking about. Can you just tell me maybe how a day and those concepts would be different than a day and
okay.
The concepts that most Americans live
well, by? It was obviously different for all of our subjects, but so maybe you'd wake up and then, you know, you hear voices downstairs. You go down and make your breakfast, and the kitchen's a mess, you know. But it's okay because, you know, that's one of the things you deal with living in community. And so maybe somebody's making breakfast, and you all can all eat it together, and you talk about where you're heading that day together. And then maybe you go outside, and somebody feeds the chickens or waters the garden. Maybe you walk by a construction project that the community's been working on. Maybe somebody's building a house out there to make more room in the main structure because it's been too cramped because someone's been sleeping on the couch for 5 months and someone finally had the idea about building another one. Maybe somebody's sitting on the porch playing a banjo and you can kind of just sit there and listen to that while you're brushing your teeth, getting ready to start your day. I mean, in some ways it's not that different than your normal American life. You wake up, you eat your breakfast, you listen to music, you go start working. But the difference is, I guess, that in these cultures, everything, all of these activities are completely intertwined with the space and the community that you're living in, rather than relying on such removed means to have them.
So you don't drive to a job. You're at the job when you wake up, basically.
Yeah. People who are really full-on homesteading and living in these ways, their life is their job. I mean, it takes a full day of work, like 5, 6, 7 days a week to subsist if you're trying to produce a lot of your food and if you're maintaining your own living space. And then beyond that, just, I mean, the work of maintaining healthy emotional dynamics within a community is constant work as well. I mean, it's funny to call that work, but it is, like, to sit down and to actually have the patience to work through frustrations and to learn how to communicate differences and come to a consensus within a group of people coming from disparate backgrounds. You know, we're not like tribes with generations upon generations of shared history. We are people that met each other in our, you know, 20s, sometimes 30s, sometimes, that have very different ideas about the world. So to bring together, like, a disparate group of 21st century Americans is work in itself.
How many people might a community consist of?
I mean, I think it could be any number. I think as low, it could be as low as, like, 3 or 4 in theory. There are some groups who call themselves communities that will have 30, 40, 100 people. I feel like once it gets too high, it's kind of hard to maintain intimacy and cohesion within a group, but that's for everyone to figure out for themselves.
How do they get started?
Lots of times they get started by, like, a single person or a group of people just has an idea and they have enough drive to get it started. Then it can kind of build momentum because other people find it one way or another, and they say, oh, wow, this is actually happening. I hear people talk about these things all the time, but, you know, it's usually just talking when you're, like, having drinks at a bar or something, and it doesn't actually go anywhere. But, you know, if you have those few people that really believe in it enough to actually commit and lay down the foundation and start building something, then it can gain momentum pretty quickly once other people see it's a reality.
You said that you visited several of these communities.
Mm-hmm.
Can you name a couple specific communities that you visited and where they were?
Yeah. One of them was really inspiring and unexpected. It was like a radical queer intentional community or safe space in rural Tennessee, of all places. It really blew my mind, like, just riding through Tennessee, and your church is everywhere and your billboards, like, telling you about how Jesus is judging you for all these things. And then you wouldn't know it, but you go through a town, which I'm not going to say what town it is, but there's, like, 70 or 150, like, queer-identifying people, like, pretty radically so, living in the countryside right there in the middle of the Bible Belt. And it's just, like, and they've been doing it for 25 years or some of them more. I mean, that's has a long history now, and they've kind of made a home there, of all places. And, you know, you go on their land, and people of all diverse gender expressions and different ways that people are learning how to live in their own skin and live with each other to expand their ideas about what a human can be, and homesteading, like we're saying. They're growing food, they're building, you know, their structures, they're organizing their own music festivals, they're really trying to bring it to that land. In the process, create a relatively self-sustaining, I mean, it's not completely self-sustaining, they bring in resources from the outside, but they're trying to gain power back through their land and through their community, and that really changed my life, being with them, I would say, the way I think about a lot of things.
How did you find that community?
It was all through word of mouth, for the most part, through most of the trip. Like, once we started to kind of start working and follow a story and meet people, people everywhere were telling us, oh, there's this place, or oh, I have this friend that lives at this thing, you should check that, or oh, have you heard about this project? And it kind of just wrote itself after a point.
It kind of brings me to, since you're saying that you did this through word of mouth, what kind of equipment did you take with you? You had the two bicycles, you and your brother.
Yes, we did. We had two bicycles, which we built from old parts at a co-op in North Carolina. Amazing experience, learned a lot. And then, of course, we had the film equipment. So, yeah, I mean, we were working with a Canon 5D Mark II, an assortment of lenses, a Zoom H4 and audio recorder, some microphones. We had a couple computers for editing, hard drives for storage, And then on top of that, we had camping stuff, a tent, a camping hammock, a tarp, sleeping bags, sleeping pads, a pair of clothes extra, a big cooking setup. That was really important to us, actually, because, like, when I can just go out camping for a night or two, I don't really need to make a big thing out of it. But when it's day after day after day, I love cooking and I love food, and so I need to be inspired through that. So we had, like, a whole spice kit and, like, three different kinds of oil sometimes. We had our olive oil and our sesame oil in these little containers, and we'd have, you know, fresh onion and garlic. And then, so we had, like, our core cooking kit, and through a lot of it, we dumpster dived a huge amount of the food we ate on the road. So we just have, like, huge amounts of vegetables or breads or meats or whatever it is that we found along the way to cook with. So we were weighed down, really heavy.
Did you do it, like, Survivor Man style, where, like, you taped your brother or your brother taped you? You didn't have any outside?
Oh, it was just us. Yeah, we didn't have any kind of support vehicle or anything like that. Yeah, that's always, that would be, really make it completely different, wouldn't it? If we were, like, this idea, like, oh, out on the road on our bikes and there's, like, a van next to us, like, and they're, like, calling in catering and somebody's, like, serving fajitas while we're making a fire. No, it wasn't like that.
But because you took part, so you were actually not just filming this lifestyle, you were taking part in the lifestyle.
Yes.
And why did you decide to take part in it?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, in some ways, the film was an excuse to live like this. I'll say that. I mean, in a lot of ways, like, we wanted to do this bike trip. We wanted to meet these people. We wanted to better understand whatever this, like, rumble in America is that we kind of felt, but from a distance. We wanted to get inside of it and feel it. And then it was like, well, we're storytellers. We want to tell a story about this. We want to create something that can inspire ourselves and other people. So we'll make a movie. And as far as why we participated, I feel like that's really the only honest way to tell a story. That's kind of a controversial viewpoint. A lot of people, journalists, storytellers, feel like they need to remove themselves so they can have an unbiased perspective. But I feel like the biases of a storyteller come through regardless of how the story is told. And the only way to really do that honestly and ethically is to embrace your biases and don't hide them and live the story you're telling and make your own journey part of that story. Make yourself a subject as well as the other people. And I feel like that's the way to tell a balanced story from my angle. So that was kind of how I tried to do it. Is we participated, we recorded our own journey, we recorded our reflections on what's around us, and we also tried to create as much space as possible for subjects to speak their mind without feeling judged or rushed or anything like that.
If I'm understanding you correctly, I don't want to say, put any words in your mouth, but you said you were feeling something was missing in your lifestyle before you started this trip, and you were hoping to find some of those missing things on the road. Can you talk about that, like what things were missing, and did you find them?
When I was much younger, I didn't really know what was missing. I felt something was missing. I had an inkling that whatever it was about my life wasn't right. And I felt very alienated, and all the values that were set before me were not appealing to me. Like the whole like track that it felt like I was supposed to be on, you know, like, I mean, you know, I don't even need to say it. Like you go to school, you start your career, you get a mortgage, you get into debt, you start like a nuclear family in the house, and you kind of like, you know, we all know that. We don't need to go into that. But that didn't make sense for me. And I didn't know why necessarily. And as I traveled around more and I started like educating myself and paying attention more, I feel like what was not satisfying about it to me was just that it wasn't real. Like in a literal sense almost. There was very little reality to my relationship with the world around me. All of the most intimate parts of your day, when you eat your breakfast or when you feel moved by a song or when you hear a story, I mean, these things were all done through very impersonal means. And I think that there's something hardwired in us, or in me anyway, that feels good to actually feel the connection to all these things and the humanity of it. And and I found a lot of that, and I've incorporated it into my life since then. I'm not much of a gardener or anything. I'm learning, but like my friends who are very good gardeners, when they, you know, pick some fresh vegetables and I eat it, it just tastes and feels better. I'm sure, I mean, it is healthy. Like, a nutritionist can tell you about how there are more vitamins in there and how fast, you know, that decomposes once it's on the shelf in a grocery store. But beyond that, I feel like there's just an emotional element of it, of actually like seeing food being grown and having somebody who you're close to or who you love harvest it and prepare it, and then to eat it with them and with the other people around you. That we've been doing that for so long as a human species that I think it just feels good, and I think that in itself is healthy. And you can extend that to, I mean, hearing music from your friend around a campfire with a guitar, or to living in a structure that you yourself had a hand in building, and you can feel that, like, what's inside of it through that. These more visceral expressions of day-to-day life were not present in my upbringing. And I think that's what was missing.
So, too, you said that there's a lot of people who might want this kind of lifestyle. Do you think that that's a new thing? Or do you think that that's, people have always wanted this kind of lifestyle?
Well, it's the very old thing. It's the oldest way for humans to live. And that's something that we forget, is that, I mean, we have not, I mean, agriculture, even agriculture itself, how old is that? 10,000 years, maybe? And how long have humans been around? Like, I don't know what a human is, what species counts as human, but 3 million years, or let's say. And then before that, of course, we were something else and something else. But like the vast majority of our evolutionary history, we were not living in these fragmented lifestyles. So we talk about these people who are trying to live more locally and as communities as kind of being alternative radical approaches. But really, that's the most like the has been tested for the longest amount of time. I think that a lot of people want to live like that, and a lot of people, and there has been a resurgence in interest in that in the industrialized world, since we're coming into, like, I don't know, like the third or fourth generation of suburban America now, and there's been a lot of disillusionment with the whole white picket fence mythology, where back in the 50s, it was like the thing to do, and then, you know, in the 60s, you saw a huge rebellion to that, and then maybe it went back and forth a little bit from then, but it hasn't gone away. It looks different now, but there's a lot of people in this country who are living very differently, and there's even more people in this country that aren't necessarily living so differently, but there's something inside of them that is telling them that they want to, but they don't know how to do that. So we're not trying to, like, force anything on anyone. We're not trying to say everybody should live like this. We're not trying to say, like, oh, you're wrong, you need to change right now. We're trying to offer alternatives and to show people that, well, there's a lot of different ways to go about life in this country and in this world. And here are some people that are doing it in this way. Something to think about. Maybe this isn't for you, but maybe there are some things in your life that you want to change, and maybe these people's example can help inspire us to find the courage to do that.
In Portland, there are a lot of places where you can learn, like, DIY things, you know, how to make your own beer, mm-hmm. how to infuse vodka, or build a chicken coop or something like that. Do you think that those speak to the same experience that you had with these people, or is that something different?
I think it absolutely speaks to the same experience. A lot of the groups that we documented, they were doing it in somewhat extreme ways, just because we were looking for those really interesting examples that were kind of outliers. But, I mean, it can be as simple as just deciding, like you say, to learn how to keep a couple birds in the backyard in the city. I mean, it doesn't mean you don't need to move out into the middle of the woods to make these kinds of changes in your life. Just to cultivate an interest in a consciousness about, like, what you consume and where that comes from, and strengthening your relationship with that thing. Yeah. So, like, these DIY things I think are great, yeah. Like, you know, figure out how to use your hands, how to use your mind, how to get together with some friends and make it happen, rather than, you know, relying on a factory on the other side of the world.
If someone wanted to learn more about the film and to contribute in some way, how could they do those things?
Well, we have a website right now that is presently being redesigned. The new one's almost up. It's americarecycled.org. You can, on the website, you can watch all of our films for free, as well as the trailer for the upcoming feature-length documentary, and you can also read a lot and see a lot of photography from it. And we are accepting donations, as we're always accepting donations. This is a very low budget production, and we have not been accepting sponsorships, or we're not selling it or anything like that. We're trying to financially sustain it through small grants and through audience donations, and this allows us to retain complete creative control and also allows us to make it available to anybody with internet access. So you can go right onto the website, and if you like what you see, we would really appreciate a little bit of money. I mean, any amount helps. So hopefully we're going to have the movie done and the premiere in January 2014 is what we're kind of hoping. Then after that, I'd love to get back on the road and tour with it and have screenings with musicians from the movie in maybe North America to start with. And we also have a sizable audience in Europe, and who knows where that could go.
Yeah, thanks for coming to talk to me.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah.
Thanks again to my guest, Noah Husson. The music you heard at the beginning of this piece was by Moses Atwood, a musician from one of the communities that Noah and Tim visited. To hear more from Moses and to see the full trailer for America Recycled, go to americarecycled.org. This has been Sarah Sneath with KBOO.
For many folks, collecting original pieces of art is thought of as something only done by an elite group of wealthy people. But Atlanta gallery owner Jennifer Schwartz is trying to change that perception. She has embarked on a cross-country road trip called Crusade for Collecting, where she drives a VW bus to different cities and holds temporary pop-up shows. And this weekend, her tour lands in Portland. This morning, KBOO's Serena Fong spoke with Jennifer about her quest to step outside the gallery and engage directly with communities.
So on Saturday, you're pulling into downtown Portland in a baby blue VW bus and having a sort of pop-up gallery for a few hours. What's going to happen at the event?
We decided to do Portland a little bit differently from the last few pop-ups that we've done in LA and also in San Francisco. We partnered with a local business and set up a little bit more fix, if you could call a two-hour pop-up a fix, exhibition outside. But for Portland, we decided it would be more fun to jump in the bus and pop out at a few different locations downtown. I'm using just three local photographers. The photographers each have 10 copies of an image that they have signed, and they're about an 8x10 size. And the goal is to just engage with the public, so anyone that's walking by, to encourage them to meet these photographers, to look at the work, to ask questions, and whichever image they like best, they get to leave with. So they become that photographer's collector on the spot.
When you say they get to leave with it, are they purchasing that piece of art?
No, they get it for free. So whichever image they connect with the most. The idea is to give people just an arts experience that they weren't expecting. To connect with an image, to connect with the story behind it and the person who made it, and hopefully value original art and supporting artists maybe a little bit more than they have in the past.
That's a pretty unique approach. What are some of the experiences that you've had as a curator or just as a member of the art world that led you to believe there was a sort of divide between people who did already buy original art and those who felt like art maybe wasn't accessible to them?
That's a great question. Because I own a photography gallery in Atlanta and I show the work of emerging artists, so these are artists that are just starting to get out there. And what I realized really early on was that more than selling their art, it's really about building an audience for them. For galleries that show more established artists, those artists are already proven. They've been accepted societally as a great artist. I'm saying that these people that I'm showing are very talented and are worth collecting and will be at that level someday. And so because photography is, it's accessible, it's affordable, it's something that we we all do. We get it. It's contemporary. And especially the photography that I show is even more affordable. So I was thinking about who my target collector was, and I really felt like it's someone who is younger and engaged and interested in things in their world, and maybe is just starting to think about art, or more likely hasn't yet but would. A lot of people are intimidated by art and by the word collector especially, and it doesn't have to be intimidating at all. And I don't want to drop the word collector, because we all collect something. I feel like collecting just means that you fall in love with something as an intentional thing. And it doesn't have to be $1,000. It can be $10. It can be anything that you connect with and that's important to you.
The word collector sort of developed almost like an elitist connection.
Right. So by getting out on the streets and bringing art to the people, my hope is that I don't think that I'm going to be converting the masses to be an art collector. I don't think that they're going to engage with this pop-up, get a piece of free art, walk down the street and walk into a gallery and buy a lot of art. But I hope that it will in some way be a transformative experience for them, where maybe in 6 months when they're looking for something to go over their couch, they're not going to immediately go to IKEA. They're going to somewhere in their brain. The point has been made that buying original art and supporting artists and being able to meet the artist, especially someone right in your community, is an experience and add more of a connection to that piece that you're going to have over your couch than buying something purely because it matches the throw pillows.
Right, you're planting seeds.
Right, exactly. Original art can also match your throw pillows, not an either or.
So for listeners who want more info, where would you direct them? And for people who want to kind of find you on the streets this weekend, where can they find you?
To find out more information about the project in general, you can go to crusadeforart.com, and that's spelled out F-O-R, art. And on Saturday, to find out the exact location, follow on Twitter, Crusade for Art, and that's with the number 4.
Thanks so much for talking with me today.
Yes, thank you.
I've been speaking today with Jennifer Schwartz. She is an Atlanta-based gallery owner who has been on a cross-country road trip and will be in downtown Portland this Saturday in a baby blue VW bus giving away free art. For KBOO, this is Serena Fong.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon. I'm Kristen Yount. Palestinian protesters clashed with Israeli military in the city of Hebron yesterday. Thousands attended the Abu Aisha Mosque to mourn the death of a 64-year-old man who died from cancer in Israeli custody. Maysara Abu Hamidiye reportedly died because he did not receive treatment for cancer of the esophagus. An exchange of rocket fire between Gaza and Israel may undermine the Secretary of State John Kerry's scheduled visit to the Holy Land later this week. Israeli President Netanyahu expressed a willingness to